Last time we ended with sort of a motivation of my favorite architecture, until recently maybe, the restricted Boltzmann machine.
RAM.
We'll explore this in a bit of detail today. And in your tutorial tomorrow, we're going to use a restricted Boltzmann machine to reconstruct the quantum state of a many qubit quantum system. So the restricted Boltzmann machine, as I mentioned last time, has a number of visible units. So it, you know, it looks very much like a neural network in the sense that it has, you know, you can draw it as having multiple layers, a visible and a hidden layer, you know, V1, V2, V3, whatever, V, I'm going to go up to M. And hidden units, H1, H2, HN, which are only connected between the layers, hence the name restricted. Okay. Just imagine that I connected them all. Okay, so the restricted Boltzmann machine is an energy-based model. It has a probability distribution defined as a joint distribution over both visibles and hiddens. It's normalized with an unknown constant, if you will, that depends on the parameters, right? In the usual way that a Boltzmann or Gibbs distribution would. And this energy function is what sort of defines this graph structure, right? So I'll use E and E lambda interchangeably. E lambda. So there's a number of parameters within the machine that are adjusted in order to learn the best representation of your state. Remember, we're doing likelihood estimation. And the first and most important is the weights. The weights I've drawn in orange here, labeled Wij between, say, units. Okay, so V was I and H was J. Right, so there's a number of hidden units. So again, it's like the Ising-Hamiltonian, where the interactions are restricted to only occur between visible and hidden nodes. Each one of these units, again, can be a 0 or a 1, 0 or a 1. In the way that we do restricted Boltzmann machines. And in addition to just the interaction energy, or whatever you want to call it, we also have a set of biases, which are learnable, BIVI, and let's say CJHJ. Weights and biases. Weights and biases. These make up the parameters, which I'm calling lambda. So weights and biases. They're vectors, and this is a matrix. So I'm just going to be sloppy with notation. Restricted Boltzmann machines, very much like the Hopfield network and so on, you know, you see exactly how they you know, represent a state. And really the point is that if you have a visible you know, state. So if you had a number of qubits, like you're going to do on your tutorial, and you want to learn a representation of the probability distribution underlying, you know, the output of some qubit state, the hidden units have to be traced out, right? So just a note, if you want the distribution over just the visibles, you would trace out or marginalize the joint distribution, H. Makes sense? So again, when I use this notation here, this is a trace, and we're going to deal with it quite a bit today. Restricted Boltzmann machines are historically very, very important technology. I'm not sure how much they're used today in industry, but they were certainly used quite a bit up until, I'd say, the kind of advent of what we consider modern deep learning. So just industry notes. Again, they were developed in the 80s. Basically, in the 2000s, they started being used for recommendation engines. Pioneered largely by Hinton and his group. You know, so I'm kind of just focusing on Hinton's group. Now, of course, the Vector Institute recently quit Google. A lot of stories about Hinton on the internet these days. Still a very active player in this field. A lot of what we're developing in this series of lectures really had its origins in Hinton. Recommendation engines, in particular what they call collaborative filtering. Which, around the 2007-ish mark, you know, RBMs are playing a big role sort of in all these types of competitions that machine learning people, you know, had on different data sets. So a really famous one was the so-called Netflix competition. Which was 2000, I might have got these backwards. These are the 2000s, I'll say. This was 2006, I believe, was a Netflix competition, where an RBM, which was only slightly modified from this architecture, was used as a recommendation engine based on users' rankings of a movie. So what you would do is you would basically, I think they had fought, you know, instead of a binary hidden visible unit, in the Netflix competition, the RBM had, I think, you know, five different states, if you will, based on your like likes on a movie. You either hate it, it's good, whatever, you know, excellent. And based on those, based on those five different rankings, this model can be trained to generate, the predicted rankings on some movie that you haven't seen yet. So it's almost, you can almost imagine how that would work. You would train a model. There's basically missing nodes or whatever that you want to generate, missing data that you want to generate. I don't think it was the best recommendation engine by any metric, but it was certainly it's a very technically, feasible engine. RBMs are also used for what they call topic modeling. Topic modeling. Which is related to sort of understanding semantic structures. I think more, commonly seen in kind of natural language applications now. And sort of roughly in topic modeling, the idea is that the latent space, is used in some sense compress, if you will, or to represent data that you would feed into the visible space. And you could have, for example, binary units, which are topics, and topics can be activated by things that you would feed into the visible space. So there's quite a bit of literature on topic modeling with restricted Boltzmann machines. And I think, but most importantly, which is in some sense motivated by topic modeling, RBMs are used as generative pre-training for deep learning kind of prior to 2012. Unsupervised, I guess. For a discrimination task, right? Remember I distinguished between generative and discriminative in the first lecture? So typically you imagine deep learning to be some sort of discriminative task. You put in a picture of a face and you want to identify the name associated with that face or something like that, right? So before the advent of really convolutional neural networks, which is 2012, RBMs are used as a sort of unsupervised first layer of some deep learning architectures, where you would feed in all, say, the pixels of an image or something like that. And then the next layer, after training, would be used to generate, a compressed or latent representation of the data that would then be fed into the discriminative part of the algorithms. So unsupervised pre-training for, deep learning. Pre-2012. So after 2012, or 2012, 2013-ish, when AlexNet came out, AlexNet was kind of the first, I think, really widely recognized advance in deep learning that's centered around convolutional networks, right? So when CNNs were adopted for these discriminative tasks, they were found to scale really well, and RBMs are essentially dropped for that application. But we still love them in science applications. So they have quite an active life these days, I'd say in physics, and as we heard this morning in our group talk, also chemistry and other topics. So let's turn away from lame industry applications and go into science applications. So let's motivate RBMs for physical data. And just to remind ourselves of the setting, we're going to talk mostly today about training an RBM, and you're going to train a real RBM tomorrow in the tutorial. But let's imagine, first off, in this data-driven setting, our goal is to train the RBM. On data drawn, again, from an unknown target. P, and I was using X yesterday, but I'll often use V today just to distinguish that the data vectors that we're feeding into the RBM are coming, you know, they're associated with the visible layer. So you have N qubits, and you have projective measurements on those qubits, right? That fixes the size of the visible layer. And again, the hidden layer can be adjusted, you know, based on how much expressive power you need in whatever your application is. So that's fine. We're going to learn all these lambda parameters, weights and biases, but then what do we do with them? So the second goal is, after training is complete, we're going to sample the RBM and calculate physical observables. So if you had an operator or an observable Q, you know, very simply, if you wanted Q, you know, evaluated in the distribution of the machine, let me put it like this, right, you can just write that essentially as an estimator and then an expectation value. You have to trace, again, Q. My Q's got less fancy here. I don't know what that is. Q, P, lambda, and the joint distribution. So for example, if you had some, you know, if you wanted to, if Q was E, right, the energy of the machine, then you could easily imagine, you know, just after you train the machine, just produce a bunch of samples, and, you know, what's the average of the energy, then boom, that would be your, you know, expectation value of the energy. Of the RBM. But more, I think physically, you could imagine operators or observables that are restricted to only be defined on your visible space, right? Because the machine has this latent space, which is essentially unphysical. Remember, you're tracing out the hidden units to get the distribution of the data, right? P of lambda V is your approximation to the unknown target distribution. So even though you can, you know, define Q over, you know, the entire state space, if you will, of the RBM, it makes more sense to imagine a physically restricted Q. I'll just call it QV. So it's only defined on the visible space. And then you can break up your trace, if you will, so that Q is on the outside, and then H, P, V, H occurs secondarily. And as you see here, this expression is exactly the marginalized distribution defined over the visible units. right? PV. So then this would be an estimator, you know, well, it's what I wrote on the left-hand side here. This would be an estimator just over the physical space. So, I mean, it's, sorry.
Sorry, I just, go ahead. When you said people use the hidden units as like a compressed version,
mm-hmm.
So it's still, they're somehow correlated somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, so what you imagine is that the some of the correlations of the visibles are encoded in there. So the simplest case you can imagine, you know, here's a visible. They're far apart by some metric, right? But there are some, you know, correlations are encoded through a hidden. So it's just a, you know, it's a, again an maybe an abstraction or something of the correlations in the system as opposed to just the physical states on the visibles themselves.
I just want to mention, like, in the definition of P, there's already the partition function, so I don't think there should be the 1 over Z, right, in the estimations.
Oh, you, yeah, you're right, probably. Yeah, because you have to... Yes. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Yihong's right. I've defined P with Z up there. Thanks. Other questions? Thanks for catching that. Okay, so we're gonna come back to point two. I mean, what are Q of V? I'll show you some examples tomorrow at the start of class, but you know, physical energy, magnetization of the state, specific heat, susceptibility, like all the common physical observables that you could imagine defining over this the physical space. So. You know, again, specific heat, magnetization of the unit, susceptibility, entanglement entropies. You could actually make estimators for those. Basically anything you could imagine writing an estimator for.
Sorry, there's an online question. What is the typical dimension of parameter space of RBM?
How many parameters would you put in an RBM that you could still train? For some of the stuff we deal with, so say you want to go up to 100 qubits, we would use 100 hidden units for some typical wave functions. So, or sorry, if you say order of 100, but maybe even less, maybe 50. So 100 times 100 is a really trainable weight matrix for sure. But I'm sure you could go bigger. Yeah. Anyone in the audience have experience? What's your maximum size RBM? What's your maximum size RBM?
I train for small systems.
I mean, do they scale as well as other architectures? I think empirical evidence says maybe not. But like certainly, like I say, 100 by 100 weight matrices have worked for us in the past.
And another question, is that all, how do convolutional neural network performances compare to RBMs for physical data applications?
So CNNs, I would imagine, are mostly used in like supervised learning tasks. So there's a big distinction there. You can use RBMs as a supervised task. You can just have one visible unit that's earmarked as a label, right? Cat, dog, that could be a label. And then you could train an RBM with that label. But I think in all those types of applications, CNNs, as far as I've seen, seem to work better. So I don't know a counterexample. But the question is for physical data?
Yeah, it said physical data applications.
That's a big space of applications, so I hesitate to say that CNNs would always be better as a supervised learning architecture, but I think definitely what we saw in industry, they always scale better. So there's some differences with the physical data we look at and the data that comes from industry applications. I mean, largely, I think in our group, we're looking at binary data coming from projective measurement distributions. So the size of the local state space could really affect the performance. And I don't have a lot of priors on that, actually. So I'm gonna focus on step one now for basically the rest of the class. And we're gonna look at training of an RBM. And I think one take-home message I want to show you guys is, you know, what parts of the learning procedure are tractable and which parts are intractable. And then, you know, that gives you some motivation for what you're going to hear tomorrow and into Mohammed's lectures, where Mohammed will introduce these autoregressive recurrent neural networks that have a very different sort of training structure. So let's focus on training. And for typical ML, I guess, applications, you know, some variant of gradient descent is typically used. Except for maybe gradient-free procedures like reinforcement learning and so on. But really, the point in gradient descent is to just update parameters, lambda, you know, through knowledge of, you know, the gradient and the cost, you know, the cost function, which I'll also say should depend on the parameters. So, you know, partial derivative of all the parameters that are you know, in some loss function. And I just wrote an eta here, which is to, you know, motivate the idea that there's a hyperparameter called a learning rate. But there's many, many hyperparameters when you're doing this type of thing. For example, the number of hidden units is a hyperparameter. The learning rate is a hyperparameter. The batch size for stochastic gradient descent, batch, B-A-T-C-H. That's another hyperparameter. So generally this, the full gradient is very costly to calculate. So if you have a 10,000 shots from your quantum computer, you know, calculating the full gradient, you know, at every step in the training, in some sense, costs too much. So in a stochastic gradient descent, you typically pull out a what they call a mini batch. If you have 10,000 shots, you might pull out 10 or 100. You calculate the approximate gradient, right, and hope that it takes you roughly downhill. I guess that's a stochastic part. You keep pulling out all those batches until you've exhausted your training set. That's one epoch. Okay. I don't know if you guys have seen that before, that nomenclature. Oh, question.
Just terminology. So I've heard the function referred to as a cost function or a loss function. Is there preference based on region, or is one more common than the other? Or
I don't know. I used to use cost function, then I switched to loss function, and there's no reason behind it. It's just I started writing L at some point instead of C. So I don't have a good answer. It's the cost, you know, you're minimizing the cost or something like that, right? I mean, I guess, but I think they're completely interchangeable. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to define this loss, this cost function or this loss function. But just keep in mind that there's like a lot of practical things that go into the actual stochastic gradient descent, and you'll get a taste for that. So for any data-driven setting, a common, and again, I'm distinguishing between data-driven and Hamiltonian-driven learning. So if we optimize these parameters based on knowledge of a Hamiltonian, it's at this point, it's a different cost function, okay? So if you wanted to minimize the energy, then you could imagine somehow you would put an expectation value of the Hamiltonian in here, for example. But for, you know, a typical data-driven setting, which is usually all they really talk about in machine learning applications, we'll define the Kullback-Leibler divergence. Oh, gotta spell it right. L. So KL, I'll just call it, I'll call it D. KL. Kullback-Leibler divergence, the thing we use all the time. Between two distributions, I'm just gonna call them big P for the distribution, that's the target, you know, and P lambda for the model distribution. Okay, so it's a for a physicist, it's a cross entropy. P x log P
x over p lambda x.
Okay. It looks like an entropy, although now that I look like at it, I'm missing a minus sign. Should I have a minus sign? I'm gonna say yes.
Yeah.
I'm on the front row, should I have a minus sign? It's got a... so it looks like an entropy is the point. Man, that minus sign is gonna haunt me. Okay. Apologies in advance. I think I dropped it through the entire derivation. Somehow I feel like I did this last time. So the Kullback-Leibler divergence, you imagine, is measuring the distance between two distributions very sort of schematically. Here is maybe the target distribution that's unknown, right? And here is the model distribution defined somehow, I don't know, p, lambda, x. And the goal of the, or the, you know, the goal of your training procedure is to make these two distributions equal, right? If your machine is producing the distribution that underlies the data perfect, that's what you want. So this is a viable cost function because, well, yeah, I know, very real schematically, if this ratio is 1, you have log of 0. So you kind of imagine that the Kullback-Leibler divergence, you know, goes to 0, right? As your distributions match.
You don't need the minus sign.
It's plus?
Yeah.
Yep. Thanks for checking. It's plus in my notes, and my notes are never wrong, so. Okay, so D, KL, what did I say, is 0 if and only if the distributions match. P equals P lambda, I'll say. And generally, the thing's always greater. Yeah, okay, always greater than 0. That's important for that sign. But it's asymmetric between the two distributions. I don't know when it matters, but right, the Kullback-Leibler divergence of P, I don't know, on small p is different than if you reverse these two. I mean, but this is the one we use for a reason. And the reason is you can break it up into two different pieces, D, K, L. One which is the entropy of the data set if x is coming from data, and the second, which is big P here, here's a minus sign, log small p here.
Roger, we have just a few questions.
Sure.
Can you comment on how you learn hyperparameters?
How do you guys learn hyperparameters? I'm teasing my guys. Hyperparameters are done through the sweat of grad students. There's no, you know, there are methods where, you know, you have, like, I don't know, meta learning or something where you can learn distributions of distributions, and those distributions of distributions are defined via hyperparameters. But to zeroth order, it's literally human effort that does it.
One other question is it possible to use rejecting sampling instead of KL divergence?
We will reject, we will use rejection sampling on the KL divergence. So I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure the essence of that question, but we will produce samples and then reject some of them. More questions?
No, that's it.
Okay. Can you see that top board? Okay, so the data part of the KL divergence, the first part, has no parameters in it, right? There's only a lambda on the second part. So if you want to use the KL divergence to learn parameters of the RBM by taking the gradient's only going to really non-trivially affect that second part. So, you know, we often write the KL divergence as, oh, here's my minus sign. Minus H of the, this is the entropy, the Shannon entropy of the data set, which is a constant, right? Given a set of data, it's a constant. And then minus, you know, the second part, which depends on the parameters, log P lambda And that second part can be written as an expectation value. Am I losing my minus sign here? Nope. So I can write this as an expectation value over x drawn from the data. I guess I'll do it like this. Log p lambda x. How do you get that second expression? You approximate this distribution, which is the unknown target distribution, with its like histogram or whatever you want to call it. The thing I wrote last time, right? With a delta function. You want me to write it?
Sorry, Roger, before you do that, do you mind swapping the upper two boards? Just, I think some people online want to see the top.
Can they see it now?
They can see a part of it now. So
that's which part?
There's no way that they can see the whole thing. But I
should I make it lower?
Maybe a little bit. Yeah, that's great. That's as good as we can do.
I don't know what the cameras are looking at. So, so if this is what I would call an estimator in language I made up. And again, it's, you know, from, I'll just write, from approximating P with XK in the data set, delta X, XK. And I talked about this before when I was talking about the difference between modeling a distribution with parameters and sort of a parameter-free estimate. But that's how I would define an estimator. And so then this thing here, I would just write as, you know, log, estimate of log p lambda, you know, I mean, I don't know, you could say from the data, or in more machine learning-like language, you know, people often would say estimator, you could say, you know, data, I don't know, comes from p x, or you would see it written like this, the estimator over that target distribution of what? Oh, change colors. Of log of p.
That orange is difficult to see.
Yeah, I see that now. So we're going to use that second expression anyway, so I'm going to write it again. So let me say that'll be our loss function then. Loss, I called it loss lambda. So there's a minus I forgot, so log p lambda. I'll say x, I don't know, x drawn from, is this how you do it? This is probably bad notation, p of x. I think I can just say p of x there. You're in the stationary distribution given to you from the data. So what we've done is thrown away the first piece. And so that makes it so that your loss function will never reach zero. There's like a constant offset. So one of the things you'll notice if you train an RBM or any of these generative models is you'll typically have a cost function that's decreasing, 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 but you never know when it's, you know, perfect. When have you learned the perfect distribution? Well, typically the entropy of the data set, you know, is sort of a, you know, it's an intractable, if you will, constant that you don't want to include in the loss function. So this is going to be our loss function. So our task now is to really calculate the gradients on this thing. Questions?
Can you estimate the entropy of the data set just by using this histogram approach as like an approximation of your target?
I guess you could, yeah.
I think you could, but in the end, like your full data set, if you're taking many batches, the estimate for that would change.
Yeah.
For each batch.
Could you just do it once where you say, like, you go get this plateau to some value in your loss function? Could you just like calculate entropy of your data?
If you do the full, the promise of your mini batch is only 10, you know, or something like it's what Yihong said, is you'll mismatch your kind of target if you calculate it over the full data set the first time. Mm. So you don't want to be doing that entropy every mini batch.
I'm just thinking like to get an estimate of what that offset is, like if you're actually reaching the zero
Yeah, so you shouldn't do that in the training step, you do that in verification.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
For verification, it makes sense to me.
Yeah, let me make a note for that. So you can include HD in verification. Yeah, so one of the points with training, I guess, which I'm trying to also get across, is you want your training procedure to be as fast and efficient as possible, right? You want to be able to train this thing kind of on as many epochs as you can to get sort of convergence. So to calculate the gradient, let me just imagine a single training, or a single element of the training set V. So and then we'll combine, okay, I started writing X here, sorry, but I'm using X and V kind of interchangeably in our case. So I'm going to, you know, then we can combine all the V's of the data set into this estimator. So just imagine that I'm calculating it for one, you know, I want log of P lambda, and then I want to take the gradient of that thing. So first off, let me just, let me just split log P lambda V, and like I screwed up already, Z is in the definition of P, and so is, I can say this marginalization over the hidden units, P lambda V, let me write this out. So let me write it just to save time. H e to the minus e v h, and when you take, you know, when you take your derivative with respect to say a weight or a bias or whatever, you know, that those weights and biases occur in that energy function. And there's two terms here which become important. So log, and I'm just going to be sloppy going forward, and log of the partition function, which I'm going to write in full as the trace over all hiddens and all visibles states, e to the minus e, right? So these form two separate parts of the loss function, you know, both of which in some sense have to be included to get an accurate gradient. The second one, okay, so the first, you know, is this a tractable calculation? Can we take the gradient and is it tractable? So basically that's what we're kind of looking into now. You should guess that, you know, there's not an easy way to make a calculation of the partition function intractable. And that's, you know, not to leave you in suspense. And the question will be, what about this piece here? And then how do we handle them?
Can I ask you to just clarify the last line of that?
Yep.
The partition function to those two separate terms.
Please. Right, so the log splits up. So I just reverse them. So minus log z, this is z. Mm-hmm. That's it. I just rewrote z here. And then the first term is log plus log. It's just what I wrote. So I've just taken the log and split it up. I can't remember now if I even defined the partition function, but that's what it is. It's a trace over all, you know, all the variables, e to the minus e. You'll note that there's no beta in there. There's no temperature.
But Roger,
that's grand.
I mean, you start with cost function, then you depend cost function. Now you depend free energy, so it looks as if you have internal energy minus entropy. So the loss function seems to be related to some kind of entropy.
Exactly. And I'd say what we'll see is that we're, you know, I've thrown away the expectation value of the data. But what'll happen here is we'll be able to calculate something over the data set and minimize the energy of the data set. But then we have the opposite sign for, in some sense, the entropy coming from the machine. So in Hopfield's original you know, procedure. He had like a learning and unlearning procedure where you learn, and then you try to like raise the entropy a bit so that you can find other minima. So one interpretation of this is very much like that. You know, there's...
So in that sense, temperature becomes meaningful now. Effective temperature.
Yeah. But what you'll see is we have to do a really crude approximation of this because it's intractable. And that gives you a whole bunch more stochasticity into the learning procedure, actually, which could have benefits, right? Sometimes you want to have stochastic things going on so that you don't get stuck in local minima. So let me plow ahead at the gradient just to illustrate a couple interesting points. So let me do it sort of a bit abstract here. I have a single training example V, and I'm calculating the partial derivative with respect to some parameter, lambda, and I'll throw something in there more concretely soon. There's the derivative of the first term with respect to lambda, which again resides in the energy function. So, and that's, I think that's right, minus. And then the second term is really just, here's the partition function again. And there's a nice way to write this if we know the definition of a conditional distribution. I don't have any better chalk. Let's see what this pink looks like here. So let's use, no, it's worse. It's worse than the orange. I'll just stick with white. Use H bar V, conditional distribution. We'll use it quite a bit here. Joint distribution over V's and V. Okay, and so if I wrote it all out, again, there's Z's that'll cancel in some way. And you would imagine E to the minus E over the marginalized, right, H E to the minus E. So just a way of writing things with conditionals. But that gives us a nice expression for the gradient. With respect to some parameter. Right? So it's like a, trace over the hiddens, weighted by the conditional here. And here is, again, the full joint distribution here. Does this one work better? We'll call this green star. We're going to use that equation again. Okay. Tractability, this is what we're aiming for. So first, let's address tractability. Is that a word? First note, these things are generally easy to calculate. So you have a whole bunch of parameters. If lambda was a weight, I got to go way back to the energy function, which I'm not going to write again. But if you take a partial derivative with respect to a weight I and j, what you should get out is minus V I H J. And if lambda was a bias B or C, similarly, you would get an expression like that. Okay, so let's look at the first term and handle that conditional distribution pH conditioned on V. Oops, can we still see that? And just look at whether or not we can calculate that first term. I already hinted that the second term, which is basically the partition function, should be intractable. I think if they're both intractable, you just give up. You go home. Jeff Hinton never would have got the whatever medal. Turing Award? By the way, I don't know, in the old literature, it looks like this is like a lot of what Jeff was doing, was calculating these traces. It's pretty interesting. I love reading papers from the 80s and 90s. Okay, so let's look at the first term. Recall the RBM graph. This gets into why it's restricted, right? I had V1, V2, H1, H2, and I have no weights that connect V to V or H to H, right? So then a distribution that's conditional, it has this property of so-called conditional independence, right? It's really just the product of, what did I label, N? I equals 1 to N. N, P, H, I, conditioned on the entire visible space. And vice versa for, you know, V. I could also, well, you get the point. So the beauty is that in essence, these conditionals can be calculated, in, let's just say, in parallel, right? So if I want to know H1, the state of H1 conditioned on the entire visible layer, right? There's no interconnectedness with H2 except through the visible layer. So that is the main simplification of the restricted Boltzmann machine. That's why it's restricted. That's why you don't include all of these other pieces. So this leads to the fact that you can calculate basically these conditionals exactly, and it will also help us simplify the trace. Exactly or analytically. I used to do this once in a while in lectures, but it takes a whole class. So I was really just doing it for my own enjoyment. And it's just a matter of pounding out that trace, really. So I'm just going to write them here. And I'll define that sigma, which you can probably guess ahead, is a sigmoid function. Where the sigmoid is a function given x, 1 over 1 plus e to the minus x. Okay? Exercise. Like, you're not busy enough, calculate that. But it tells you a lot because it says that the conditional distribution, which is going to be part of that first term in the green starred equation, is going to be calculatable for each hidden unit just, you know, through this sum, which either runs through the number of visibles or the number of hiddens. So when we're talking about machines of the size, I was saying, 100 hiddens and 100 visibles, that's a pretty small sum, no problem. The conditional distributions are, you can assume they're gonna be tractable. Let's put them in the full first term of the cost function, just to see if there's any tricks. So first term in star is let's use the weight just so I can have something concrete. That's, I think there's a minus sign there. I'm getting less confident on my minus signs. You ever notice how you just write h bar automatically and you can't help it? That's supposed to be a vector sign. P, I just wrote the same thing here. IJ, I wanted HI here. I'm gonna say JI, just so I don't screw up my notes. Because I want HIVJ. Okay. So the point of this label, HI, so I've just pulled, you know, I've gone back through the, I've gone to the neural network diagram there and I've pulled out, you know, one of the weights, WJI here, and I want to update that weight. The state of the hidden unit I occurs in that expression, but I'm tracing over all possible values, right? VJ will come, in this case, from the data set or something like that. Okay, so how do we take that trace? We still need that trace, but you know, it's a trace over a bunch of conditionals, and then one conditional is special because it's multiplied by HI. So you got to pull out the I out of that list of hidden units. Okay, so I'm actually going to just break this up, and for the sake of notation, HI condition on V, P, H, vector, everything but I, which I'm going to use minus I as the notation, condition on V. Okay, so I've just split that up into a product of one special conditional distribution and everything else. Let me move that board up. Ooh, doesn't sound good.
In future, the speakers will be lifted up.
What's that?
The speakers will be lifted up so that you...
That's a good idea. Remember, who had the climate lecture? Was it Al Gore or somebody? And he was on this like thing that lifted him up. Remember? Okay, so that notation, all hiddens that aren't I. So I'm just doing this to illustrate, I think, what's again special about the RBM. The conditional independence of the graph makes a lot of these traces simpler. And then I don't know why, but I'm just, I guess, obsessed with the trace. So to keep going here. So if I pull out the special HI piece, HIVJ, and then everything else. Yep. I mean, it's not looking great because you still have this sum here. But remember, the trace over H minus I is like the product of all the individual sums over states. So let's assume I is not, I don't know, one. One. And then two, you know. So that second piece has all of these traces in it. And then for each element here, just to abuse the chalkboard, you're summing over, you know, H1 equals zero, condition on V, right? Plus conditional of H1 equal to one, condition on V. What's that?
One.
It's one. So you have one to the power n minus one. So you get one, what is it? Is it n? N minus one here. So I think that's one of the beauties of the conditional independence. And then all that's left over is the first term. So just to go back here. So trace over hi, hiv. Now you have an hi here. So you got to deal with that. And you have a vj. But again, you have p of hi equals zero, and you have a zero here. And then you have the one term. So that's the expression. And VJ follows this one along here. And in the end, that's all you get. So P, HI equals one, condition on V, which is that sigmoid function. We already calculated it, sigmoid sum over K, W, IK, VK, plus CK. So I added a dummy index because I already used J. That's it. So when you calculate the first term of that expression in green, you can, again, you can do it just by calculating that sigmoid, which is, again, a sum over, say, 100 or some relatively small number of units. So the first term's tractable. And so I'll just put it here, tractable. And it's really just the second term that's intractable. You can ask the question, can I break up the second term and use this trick over, you know, sum over conditionals again? So it's completely valid. But you'll still have a problem. So if I just looked at the second term, right, you have P, okay, so you have trace, VH, P, V. If I wanted to break this up, how would I do it? I could use, well, okay, I'll do two steps. VH, derivative, and if you use PV, so if you use the joint distribution, is something like, you could do it like this. There's two different ways of doing it. V, and then the next one's H conditioned on V. All right, so I could break up that H condition on V in the same way as I did right there. But to make a long story short, you're still gonna have in this term, you're still gonna have the sum over V's, PV, right? And then the H, P, H conditioned on V. And then whatever the derivative is. Let me just move that up. So if I believe from my first argument that this can somehow be made tractable, I've still embedded that into a sum over 2 to the m states, right, for that trace. So the trace V has 2 to the power m elements. So that's how I define intractable.
Does having your visible unit not fully connected gain you anything here? Or could you do the same derivation if that was fully connected as well?
You need both visibles and hidden to have no connections, because you have to do this twice. You need to know the conditionals of P, V condition on H, and vice versa. So let me tell you why. So it's because you sample this thing. That's the simple explanation, but maybe I'll spend the last 10 minutes and talk about that sampling. So if you want to sample a restricted Boltzmann machine, which is a representation of a joint distribution over V and H, you do it in two steps. You typically sample all of V's conditioned on H's, then you fix those and do the opposite. So it's because you go back and forth like that you need to have them both conditionally independent. That's called Bloch-Gibbs sampling. So let me just write the answers. Do I need to say anything else about this? Basically, what we're doing is now embedding this into I mean, the only step that we threw out was this is only on one training element. Okay. Well, so maybe that's worth saying. Oops. Oops. Who knows which one? Yeah. So let me just leave that up for a minute. So putting it all together, the loss function is, remember, log PV, which I can take V from the data set, your projective measurements from your quantum computer. All right, so I've written that as the estimator. And so basically then, this expression, so then you take the derivative and you just put this expression into this expression here, and that leads to a slightly more general way of writing. I can imagine doing it with expectation value notation, so H V conditional. That's the tractable piece. I'm just writing it in, you know, you take the sum over V's to complete the expectation value here. So it's a sum over the data set. And then this one, the second term, which is the intractable term, remember, has the derivative, that's the gradient piece, the partial derivative with the respect to the parameters. But it's drawn from the joint distribution of the machine, because that's really the trace. So another way of doing it, of writing it, is you know, you have to take the gradient with respect to the data. This is what I was saying to Bhaskaran for the first term, and then the gradient with respect to, I don't know, the joint distribution of the machine, the RBM. So those are called the positive and negative phase of the RBM, if anyone ever says that. I feel like I got the signs wrong, but it's either the log likelihood or the negative log likelihood. You're either minimizing one or maximizing the other. So it's again, the learning procedure, data-driven. In some sense, you're lowering the energy of the data set, and then you know, driven by the energy of the machine, you know, the distribution of the machine. So in these two different phases. So the negative phase needs to be approximated. Like, how do you calculate that expectation value if it's intractable? And that's where largely the Markov chain Monte Carlo procedures come in. And again, one of the big themes of what we're doing here is comparing these energy-based models, which are, you know, explicit likelihood, if you will, or explicit density models, that are intractable versus the explicit density models that are tractable that we're going to learn about going forward. Okay, so the intractable piece is sampled with Markov chain Monte Carlo. And it's a special type of Markov chain Monte Carlo called Bloch-Gibbs sampling. So you might have heard of Gibbs sampling in some other contexts, which typically you can imagine uses conditionals. Or you've heard of a Metropolis update, which is a little different than a Gibbs sample. But for an RBM, really, you're thinking of, you know, you're in configuration space, and you have hiddens and visibles. And so you're imagining starting maybe with an initialized visible vector, you know, and using that to sample, you know, through the conditional probabilities, the hidden state, and then, you know, the Markov chain proceeds like that. Hidden, visible, hidden, visible. And so on. So if you were, you know, calculating that full expectation value, now imagine during your learning procedure, you have to run a Markov chain and produce enough samples to get an accurate estimate every single training iteration, which is you can just tell is not going to work. So what actually happens in practice is a procedure called contrastive divergence. CDK. Again, invented by Jeff Hinton. So Hinton was working on this stuff and wanted a way to train an RBM, and he came up with it, basically. Contrastive divergence means approximating the, you know, expectation value of this second piece just with, you know, one state, you know, which you would never do, right? But if you want to calculate the energy for, you know, just one configuration, you just can do that. And you just pick one configuration along this chain. So the Markov chain is run for k steps. That's where the k comes from. Run block Gibbs for k steps. And, you know, use one sample. There's many variations of this, of the hidden and visible and hidden state on the second term. So again, as you can imagine, that is a very big approximation to that second term. But it works in practice, is one point. So even though it's sloppy, RBMs can be trained, you know, via contrastive divergence. Again, there's a bunch of sampling that kind of goes on inside of the machines. But this is kind of the thing that you need to do to get over the fact that the partition function is an intractable object in some sense. So I think the take-home message, or one of the take-home messages on these energy-based models is just this. I'm going to leave it there so we can break early for lunch. Early? I don't know. It's lunch. And what I'm going to do tomorrow at the start of lecture is show some examples of training of an RBM on data very similar to what you're going to be looking at in your tutorial. And then for the, you know, for half an hour after that, I want to introduce an autoregressive architecture that you can motivate from the RBM. So it'll be your first autoregressive model. Not in common use today, a NAID, but I mean, very, very sort of famous architecture. And then that'll lead into, I think, the recurrent neural network lectures of Mohammed very nicely. So any questions?
Product representation of the RBM probability distribution remains one of some kind of emergent collective degree of freedom because they are not interacting, they are not communicating.
Right. So, yeah, so each visible, right, so in this sample here, say you want the visible, you know, state, this subscript now means the time on the Markov chain. So I'm abusing notation, but here's your Markov chain. You would calculate this through a typical Metropolis procedure where you suggest an update and then there's an acceptance or rejection step. So when I talk about rejection sampling, this is where it comes in. So the suggested update comes from the conditionals, and those conditionals can all be done in parallel. So every time you sample, you know, you could do it, boom, if you have 100 visible units, you can do all those, calculate the conditionals all in parallel, multiply them together. And that would be your suggested next hidden state or something like that. So it's actually very fast and parallelizable and so on. The question, you know, the question of convergence of an RBM then starts boiling down to, I would say, a lot of the way you handle the hyperparameters, the size, what the quality, you know, the complexity of the distribution, how well your contrastive divergence works, and so on. But I, you know, certainly in physical applications, RBMs have been very successful in learning complex physical distributions from data. So I would argue that, you know, except I think in practice we see RNNs work better. If you the first thing you could imagine doing if you had some data set drawn from an unknown target distribution, it'd be very easy to throw it into an RBM and just see if you can get a good learning procedure on that. So I think in our field now they've become quite widespread because in practice they work really well. Other questions?
I guess you kind of already commented on it, but like if you were doing some estimate on this entropy term, is there and that you still get good physical results? Is there like an idea that maybe this term has less of an impact on what your state is, depending on what you're trying? Or are you...
The entropy term I dropped?
No, sorry. The intractable term of your loss function.
The negative, this phase here?
Yeah, maybe this wasn't what I was thinking then.
If you drop that term, I don't think you get good behavior.
No, I mean that you're doing some sort of estimate on it that might not be very good, but you still get good results. And does that mean that this term doesn't really contribute much to your loss function?
No, I think it contributes, but you're kind of, it's a trade-off on like how much for, you know, you're doing training over a number of epochs. So you're selecting a mini batch, you know, exhausting the data set epoch one. You might have to train for 1,000 epochs. But if every mini batch costs you a week to calculate an expectation value, it's kind of a trade-off, right? You get a higher quality negative phase. But if you're doing it early on in training anyway, there's all sorts of other things going on there. And so I think there's like a trade-off issue, you know. You can improve this. You could have a rough estimate, you know, averaging over a few independent samples and all sorts of things. People do all sorts of stuff. Persistent contrastive divergence, where you start your Markov chain from the previous iteration. So it's more like annealing. People do all sorts of things like that. So that'll help. Almost anything you can think of. But I think in practice, it's really very much of a trade-off between how much time you want to spend on that Markov chain sampling and how many epochs you want to train for in total. Hyperparameters. Grad students, sweat and blood. More questions? I don't know if I want that to be the last thing on this recording. Too late. We're good online? Oh, one back here.
So given the system like that, like the visible layer and hidden layer, so when we exclude the intra-layer pairs, so is this energy the unique one we can assign?
Is it a unique energy that we can assign to?
I mean, is this energy, the expression, unique? Like, can we have another expression to be the energy?
I'm not sure what the gist is. I mean, I think it is unique in the way we've... Are you saying, is there another energy function that might work better?
Yes.
I don't know of one.
No. It's a simple spin model with nearest neighbor.
Yeah.
There is this matrix gauge transformation.
Uh-huh.
There are many, many which are connected by a local gauge transformation.
I see.
Which can be, so that may be
kind
of non-uniqueness. So, if, for example, you take a ferromagnet, then you can make sign change of the bonds in a way that every product of elementary loops remain the same.
I see. You could add terms like that. You could add higher order. So you have a two-body term. You could add a three-body term, for example.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if you want to, but but I think they're...
Even within two-body terms, you can go from one JIJ to another JIJ through a matrix transformation.
I see.
They may look very different to begin with on the face of it, but then internally they are the same. Then, of course, two higher-body terms.
You know, I haven't thought about it very much, and I don't think a lot... I mean, I think physicists, we've adopted the architecture and used it. I don't think we've adapted it that much. So I think there's a lot of, you could explore this quite a bit. So yeah, sorry, I don't have a great answer.
Because I think like if we have a high order term, like we necessarily have like a point in one layer talk to another.
Yeah.
Same layer.
Yeah, I can see that, like a triangle or a square. Yeah. People have looked at continuous variables instead of binary variables.
Yeah.
And so there's like Gaussian RBMs, and you can imagine an XY model instead of a Ising model. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can certainly imagine those types of things. They're higher symmetry models. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One hard thing with the RBMs is it's not all that easy to put in symmetries. If you want a U1 symmetry, for example, you have to abandon Gibbs sampling, I think. So you have to abandon this type of update. You have to come up with something on your own, some type of metropolis type sampling.
But it's doable.
I think it's doable. I think what we've found is in the autoregressive structures, everything's easier. So U1 symmetry in an autoregressive model is much easier in kind of within current frameworks than doing it in an RBM.
models.
Yeah, no, these are good questions to ponder. And I love to think that the RBM isn't dead. I love to think that there's still research to be done on the RBM in our field. So let's keep it alive.